This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, 7:35 a.m. on Thursday, the 7th of April. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Sani here with me, and we're going to be looking at the biggest business news of the day, including the deal to make the world's biggest drug company is off. And also, the Riksbank is courting controversy again. Let's kick it off with this mega pharmaceutical deal. So America's Pfizer was planning a $160 billion merger with the maker of Botox, Allergan of Ireland. But they've since walked away from the deal. Why, Yim? What happened?
Well, you know, the whole deal was suspect to begin with. It wasn't some sort of trying to find some synergies between their businesses. It wasn't trying to find overlapping market share. It's just about tax evasion or tax, trying to find their way around paying more tax.
Tax avoidance.
That's right. So, yeah, that's the whole story to this.
Okay, so I think we spoke a little bit yesterday about U.S. authorities and the push to try to keep U.S. businesses at home rather than moving their headquarters to a low-tax domicile. So, clearly, the deal being called off is seen to be a major win for President Barack Obama. Here he is.
The overwhelming majority of folks work hard and they play by the rules, and they deserve to see their hard work rewarded. They also deserve to know that big corporations aren't playing by a different set of rules, that the wealthiest among us aren't able to game the system. So I am very pleased that the Treasury Department has taken new action to prevent more corporations from taking advantage of one of the most insidious tax loopholes out there and fleeing the country just to get out of paying their taxes.
And that's President Barack Obama talking about the law of inversion, basically transactions where U.S. companies take a foreign address through a merger with a smaller firm.
I like how Julian described it yesterday. He said it's as if you are an American national, but you hold a British passport.
Yeah.
You spend all your time in America, but you pay British taxes and the like.
Yeah,
but if we were to look at the U.S. corporate tax rate, it's really quite high if you compare to the other countries.
That's true, because, you know, I mean, on top of the fact that U.S. is the land of the brave and home of the free, or whichever the order that comes in.
Does that apply to in the corporate world?
They do. And because of that, you know, you can do anything you want there. You can even sell legalized marijuana if you want to in some states. But you have to pay the price, and the price is at 35% corporate income tax, which is really high. To contrast that against Malaysia, we're paying about 26-27%. But in other areas, like Ireland, for instance, it's extremely low teens even.
Yeah.
So these new laws to prevent companies from doing inversion tactics, but they're not retrospective. So the rules will disregard the 3 years of past mergers with U.S. corporations in determining the size of the foreign company. So it will only look ahead. And that's why Pfizer and Allergan moved away from this deal.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Ireland and the level of corporate taxes there, because Allergan is off Ireland. So, you know, if the merger had gone through, that would allow Pfizer to cut its tax bill by about $1 billion annually, domiciling in Ireland. We've also seen some other inversion deals, and how much that's cost the US government. We're talking about billions here. Ohio-based Eaton Corporation moved, and I'm using air quotes here,
moved to
Ireland a few years ago. Also, Medtronic, which is a Minnesota-based medical device manufacturer, also shifted its home to Ireland by buying Covidien, which is an Irish medical device maker.
So as you can see, this is a real thing. You know, corporations in the US actually moved to another area, like Ireland, by acquiring smaller firms there. So the White House is getting a little bit more aggressive in blocking these kind of deals from going through. In fact, just recently, as recent as yesterday, the U.S. government plans to block Halliburton and Baker Hughes and says it is anti-competitive, but actually they want to block on this anti-inversion kind of tactic from taking place.
Yeah, so this is where it gets a bit dicey, because of the loopholes in the law. It's technically not illegal to do that. But, you know, again, it's like the tax avoidance versus tax evasion. And that's why, you know, with the Panama Papers, all this has kind of come to light in recent days.
That's right. So the question right now is, in fact, the theme of this morning is, if it's not illegal, but it's not but it's not ethical, do you still do it?
There's a theme.
And that's why President Obama, in the clip that we heard just now, talks about this being a very insidious kind of tax loophole that corporates is going to exploit. The problem here is that, is it the fault of the corporates trying to save money on paying more tax, or is it the problem of the US government not having enough laws to close these loopholes? That is the larger question right now.
Okay, so now they're trying to fix that with these tighter regulations. I also remember reading something about tax amnesty, so companies who come back, they're not, you don't have to pay back taxes, if
That's
I'm not
right.
mistaken. But it's high time that the US take a look at this, because US companies have squirreled away trillions and trillions of dollars. More than $2.1 trillion were held by the top 500 largest US corporations in offshore accounts in tax havens, according to recent research.
So this is where the conspiracy theories start creeping up, because the recent expose of the Panama Papers did not reveal much about those American companies and Americans themselves in hiding in Panama.
Is that a conspiracy theory, or do you think there's a legit angle to that?
I think there's a legit angle, because George Soros's corporation, they have an entity, an NGO, and they are apparently funding the ICIJ, or the very organization that released the Panama Papers. So if there's no smoke without fire, and if there is smoke, what kind of smoke are we talking about? That's the $2.1 trillion US dollars that you spoke of, Melissa.
There you go. It's now 7:41, and Sweden's central bank monetary policy, which includes having negative interest rates, well, that's attracted some criticism from people like Janet Yellen and Paul Krugman. But the central bank may now be on the cusp of a change in its monetary policy, because a growing number of analysts are anticipating an end to 2 years of aggressive rate cuts.
That's right. So this is amid the housing bubble problem that they have. This is also trying to stem the stimulus program, but it's not enough to meet its inflation target. Now, if you look back through time, they hit about 3% inflation rate in 2011, but they've gone well below the 1% rate for the past 3 or 4 years, and they have not done much in terms of propping up that inflation rate numbers.
So the central bank, so Sweden's central bank, which is the oldest central bank in the world, I might add, they've got a target for inflation 4%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they, 2%. And they haven't met that target for the past 4 years.
So the question is, do you still use the same things?
It's clearly your weapon is not working. Do you need to change in your arsenal?
Yeah, so by them changing their method, right now we have some reports that they might improve on another way of improving their stimuli. But whatever it is, these rules may impact Swedish businesses overseas. And if you know that Sweden is going big in Malaysia, household names like IKEA, mm-hmm. Volvo, Saab, Atlas Copco, they are earning billions of ringgits from revenues in their Malaysian markets. And this is just Malaysian. But the risk bank rules back home in Stockholm may impact these companies' expansion growth elsewhere, not just in Malaysia, but elsewhere in other emerging markets. Right. If you remember, Sweden has a very small population and the market is very small. They have to rely on their export market. So if they can't raise funds at home, then they may go to another market where they can actually raise funds. So in this sense, they're going for the opposite inversion of that American corporates.
whether that's legal / ethical is another question, right? But again, to quote Julian Ng, money has no nationality.
That's right.
But going back to the inflation target that we were talking about in Sweden, there were reports, with the current situation with the migrants coming in, the refugees coming into Europe, there were reports, or analysts were thinking that perhaps the effect of refugees coming in could add some, could push the inflation numbers up. But we haven't actually seen that, have we?
No, we've not seen inflation numbers go up because of the influx of the refugees and migrants coming in. And it's a large population, mind you. In fact, right now, it's about 4 to 5% of the Swedish population. Last year, we saw 500,000 refugees trickling in through the gates of Stockholm. But the migrant agency sees refugee cost reaching about $7.1 billion. So while it doesn't prop up the inflation rates, it does prop up the need for them to fund these refugees. So where will the $7 billion come from, if not from taxes? And where is going to come from if the revenue isn't going to be that high. So Sweden is indeed in a rut in terms of trying to prop the economy in general.
Okay, I would like to see what this means for negative interest rates. I mean, it's been said that this has been a giant social experiment from central bankers. Whether that is in fact true, whether it has worked, Sweden is about to become a test case. 7:45 right now, and more business news in just a minute on BFM 89.9. Good morning. This is The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Ibrahim Saini. 7:45 right now. It's Thursday, the 7th of April. Coming up on The Breakfast Grill, a special guest today, Dato' Sri Karimullah bin Mashirul Hassan, former group editor-in-chief of New Straits Times Press. We often know him more familiarly as Kali.
So that's right. So Dato' Sri Kali has had a long career in journalism and in the corporate world as well. But he has recently launched his book and now he can add being an author to his very long list of achievements.
Yeah, that's right. So he's coming on The Breakfast Grill to discuss this new book, which is basically a collection of his columns on Sunday Times. But according to Sharad Kutan, who will be doing the interview, the postscript is what's interesting because apparently he names names. So we'll talk more about that, including details of the administration of former Prime Minister Tun Abdul Ahmad Badawi.
That's right. And if you need to ask him anything, just tweet us at BFM Radio or send us an SMS at 016-201-9000.
Yeah, you can join the conversation. Breakfast Grill, Dato' Sri Karimullah Hassan will be on the grill. Sharad Kutan will be speaking to him then. Back to business news, Ibrahim. RHB Capital, they've unveiled details of its new internal revamp, which will see it transferring its entire stakes in its subsidiary to RHB Bank, and this is for 3.4 billion ringgit in cash.
Now, of course, this is a larger story here. I think this is a progressive step towards them being relisted on Bursa, and there is a reason why they want to relist their bank entity instead of their financial holding company. So we're talking about they want to list RHB Bank Berhad and not RHB Capital Berhad. So in order for them to do so, they have entered into a series of sales and purchase agreement between these two entities and trying to make each one of them better capitalized compared to the other.
Okay, does it make any difference to the way the company is run, or is it just a like a structural change?
Yeah, essentially okay. It's a structural change because Basel III is very critical on how financial holding companies or FHCs are managed. So these new structural milestones are made in order to make the RHB Capital less capitalized and make RHB Bank Berhad more capitalized. And one of the tools that they used is a share sale agreement.
Okay. I guess I'm wondering whether it's timely to do this because we've seen kind of analyst reports, research reports saying that the banking sector really is in focus, headed for some tough times.
That's right. Remember that RHB actually removed some jobs because they want to manage their operational costs. And they're not alone in this. CIMB did the same. And the banking sector in itself and in its entirety, they try to reduce cost overall. But on top of that, they have to improve on their balance sheet. So far, RHB has raised 2.35 billion in rights issue up until December last year. So its holding company will be focusing more on the management of smaller companies within its subsidiary, and they try to make their bank as much capitalized as possible.
Okay. We're taking a look also at BSI because the global investigations into 1MDB, well, that's been cast, that has cast a deepening shadow over one of the Swiss bankers, BSI. So reportedly, several senior employees have left BSI Singapore's office in recent months, or in fact, they may be leaving soon, I'm not quite sure. But and this includes the three members of the bank committee that vetted major new clients at the time when money flowed in from 1MDB.
That's right. So one of the major new clients, so-called, that they had to vet through was Low Tech Joe, better known as Joe Low. Mm-hmm. And this has implicated at least one private private banker of that bank, which is but goes by the name of Yat Yew Chee. He is a senior banker and has since quit the bank since March 2016. And you know, his last salary was over $80,000, and that's plenty of salary per month, mind you. And this is a lot to earn from a small bank. Even though it's a private bank, they don't have much clients. So the question is, what kind of unlawful benefits that he received, and can he defend himself in the court of law?
Yeah, okay. So BSI, they were the ones who, so the Singapore office were the ones who managed the account for 1MDB, right? And there was also the Brazen Sky, if you remember, the Brazen Sky Fund.
Yes.
Yep.
And also the Abu Dhabi ABA investment is also lumped into this whole 1MDB saga. So Malaysia, of course, have said that the 1MDB Corporation has transferred over $1 billion from the Cayman Islands into BSI Singapore. This is reported by Reuters. And the question now is, why would BSI Singapore need that much funds if everything is on the level right now?
Well, I also saw a report that came out talking about Tim Leisner, the former Goldman Sachs banker.
Right. So now we know why Leisner's departure from Goldman Sachs happened. Apparently, the letter, he signed a letter that was written on Goldman Sachs' letterhead to another bank on behalf of Joe Low. This implied that Goldman Sachs had vetted Joe Low, and this also implies that Goldman Sachs had done business directly with him. In fact, the firm has not conducted that level of due diligence, and its name shouldn't have been used for him.
It wasn't authorized.
So Tim Leisner had to pay the price, and he had to walk away from the bank.
Okay. It's now 7:51 a.m. and WhatsApp has announced it will encrypt all its users' communications. And that was a couple of days ago. I don't know whether you've gotten any messages in your WhatsApp chat groups.
So they rolled this out because they have, get this, 1 billion active users right now on WhatsApp. They had to roll this encryption end-to-end in stages. And the question is, why did they want to do it? So the bigger question is on the destruction of evidence versus the increased level of privacy. And that's the core question that WhatsApp wants to solve right now. Melissa, if you remember the Apple saga with FBI, in fact, the whole question of privacy, irrespective of who that private chat or private communication belongs to, whether it's the good guys or the bad guys, the tech companies say that, well, we don't care who you are. We want to ensure that your level of privacy is going to be maintained. So WhatsApp is taking that stage one step further, and they want to preempt this from going anywhere.
Okay, so they were spooked by what happened between the FBI and Apple. So we've got Russell Brandon, who is from the tech website The Verge, and he follows WhatsApp. And here he is explaining what end-to-end encryption means.
We're talking about destruction of evidence, right? And what if police need evidence? I mean, one example people use is, you know, they say the biggest tool for destruction of evidence, certainly in drug cases, is the flush toilet. Because as soon as they go to arrest the people, they flush the drugs down the toilet and then there's no evidence. But of course, we keep flush toilets around, you know, in every building we're in because we need them for other things. The balancing between, well, what if we could have found out this one piece of information that we didn't know, compared with a billion different users of WhatsApp, I think it's genuinely a hard balance to strike.
That was Russell Brandon, a tech journalist with The Verge. What do you think? I mean, do you have any strong feelings about this? And does it make you feel better that your WhatsApp chats are encrypted?
I do feel better.
Really? You know,
because,
why?
Look, first of all, terrorists, if they want to communicate, they will communicate with whatever means possible. Either at the Mama stall or at the desert somewhere in Syria or through WhatsApp. Now, if you close down WhatsApp, it just means that they probably might use WhatsApp more, but it doesn't mean that all of us, the rest of us, the 1 billion users of WhatsApp, need to suffer and need to have our privacy being encroached by either law enforcers or hackers just because, you know, of the, you know, tens or few of these terrorists. That's my honest opinion.
I really wonder whether this will make a difference to the wider WhatsApp community. I do think that it was, you know, kind of a smart move on WhatsApp's part to take a proactive stance? I mean, after they saw what happened with Apple and the FBI, they said, okay, we're going to do something to protect our encryption. Will this make a huge difference to the users of WhatsApp, to the way WhatsApp makes money? I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, if you recall how WhatsApp makes money, you know, they have dropped their yearly subscription of $1 US in February this year. Now they're looking for potentially charging businesses to access a special API, something that you can use. It's called the Application Program Interface. Mm-hmm. This allows for corporations to allow them to hook into existing customer service tools and allow them to manage their businesses better. So they're trying to monetize WhatsApp even better. But the business model of WhatsApp was never to make money in the first place. It's to understand customer data. And right now, because of the end-to-end encryption, I'm not too sure whether WhatsApp can actually mine their own customers and try to develop some sort of consumer behavior. I'm not too sure now they can do it.
Okay. 7:55 right now, and I want to give some props to Digi Telecommunications because yesterday they announced a new 6-month fully paid maternity policy for all its employees, and that is that had started from the 1st of January this year. So according to a statement that they made, they say they are extremely proud to institute the new global 6-month standard maternity leave here in Malaysia. Their goal is to attract and retain some of the best talent, male or female, and they're confident that this policy will make Digi an attractive place to work. I have to say props to them because 45% of Digi employees are women. So good on them.
That's right. In fact, I really applaud this. You know, the amount of energy that is going to be given in terms of empowering women through maternity leave means that when they are at work, they are more productive. But the problem with Malaysian workforce is not just restricted to, say, the maternity leave. It's also the ability of women entering the workforce. Now, I'm not saying that every woman must work, but I'm saying that if two women can work, but only one of them are working in Malaysia. And by the way, that's the official number. Only 52% of women in Malaysia can work is working. I don't know whether we are getting enough labor force or talent in the market because Malaysian women are not attracted to working in Malaysian corporates.
Well, okay, you're right. I mean, I see some points that you've made, but I think it's a complex issue here, right? There are many reasons why women drop out of the workforce pipeline. I do think it's really good that Digi has done this. 6 months is fantastic. I mean, this is fully paid from, what was it, 3 months previously, right?
That's right.
So more time with children. But I think it has to be added with a whole different layer. So you also need to provide incentives, or not incentives, but support for women to be able to come back to work.
Yeah, childcare,
creches, for instance.
And they can do really, really well because next week I'll be interviewing the head of IBM Malaysia, and she is a far capable individual for IBM. She dropped out of work twice from IBM, but IBM was more than happy to accept her back. And those two occasions that she dropped off was because of the fact she needed more time with in building a family. So imagine if corporates are more susceptible to try and get more women back into the workforce, we're going to get a better talent pool now.
I was also reading that in San Francisco, I believe they've, was it a whole year of parental leave? I'm not sure. Let me just
double check.
But this is parental, right? So father and
father. So they share between themselves. So this is a little bit complex. You've got to talk to two employers now.
Okay. So when you had your kids, Yim, how many days did you take off?
I had 3 days paid paternal leave.
I mean, and it's got to be fair, right?
That's
you're talking
right,
about
that's
gender
right.
rights.
Now,
you got to give the dad some
absolutely. So this
baby
is
time.
When my wife had to take unpaid leave to care for our children, particularly when you know for a fact that on a lifelong basis, if children are breastfed over 2 years or at least 2 years.
I'm not going to go into the breastfeeding debate.
That means that the child can grow to be a more functioning a member of the community, and the state can pay lesser in terms of managing that individual. But one thing is for certain, of all the companies out there, tech companies are indeed leading the charge in empowering women. Amazon has 5 months paid leave. Adobe has 6.5 months paid leave. And Netflix is thinking of giving one full year off. And that
is
fantastic.
Okay,
yes.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll see more Malaysian companies follow the footsteps of Digi Telecommunications. 7:59 right now, we've got the Breakfast Grill coming up on the other side of the 8 o'clock news bulletin. Dato' Sri Kalimullah Hassan, former group editor-in-chief of New Straits Times, will be on the grill. Make sure you stay tuned for that. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.